tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Today is just a couple of days after Asalha Puja, and Asalha Puja being the day that the Buddha first taught the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta to the group of five ascetics in the deer park in Benares, the first sermon. And as if to commemorate that on that specific day, a few people noticed how strong the moon was. And I remember that night Patrick came and said that he hadn't been able to sleep because the moon was so bright. And it seems from the paper today that actually the moon was the closest it had been to the earth all year. So they had a very spectacular photograph of the moon over Poseidon's temple in Greece. So that was just obviously the moon's putting on a special celebration for Asalha Puja. So the Buddha has special preference for the full moon nights, and it seems like on that night it's kind of the psychic sensitivity is heightened because the kind of the energy in the air is kind of tingle. So the story of the teaching of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma, is something that I like to come back to very often and tell this story very often. It should be something we're ingrained, that's ingrained in us, that's fundamental to our understanding of the Dhamma. It should be the starting point, the alpha and omega of what actually Dhamma means to us. So this kind of idea of rolling forth the wheel had this implication in India of being something that's very powerful, unstoppable, like the wheel of the sun in the sky, or the wheel of the moon. Something no one can turn back. This energy that's kind of moving. And also, of course, the wheel is a symbol of wholeness, completion. And the eight spokes of the wheel, of course, being the eight limbs of the Eightfold Path. Again, the number of eight connoting completion and balance and fulfillment, perfection. So this Noble Eightfold Path being something which is neither deficient nor excessive, doesn't contain anything which is unnecessary, nor is it missing anything that's necessary. When Buddha first came to see the group of five ascetics, we should understand the context that that's taught in. So many times we see Dhamma phrases and so on, people picking here bits and pieces here and there, like crows going and picking all the shiny bits out to decorate their nest with. And as was said so wisely by Shakespeare in The Merchant of Venice, the devil can quote scripture for his purpose. And he frequently does, yeah? And so Mara can very easily quote the Tripitaka for his purpose. And I'm reminded of this because I was shown this book just before we came up here. It was Beliefs Without Buddhism or something like that. And, oh sorry, Buddhism Without Beliefs, sorry, my mistake. And, you know, you could just see the way that ideas are being picked out, like a crow would pick something out of context and being picked up and twisted around to mean something entirely different from what it actually meant in that particular context. So, for example, we have a teaching on mindfulness in daily life. The Buddha taught us to be mindful in our daily life, so that's fine. And you can see, for example, in the Digha Nikaya, that teaching on mindfulness in daily life is integrated into the monastic lifestyle, the life of one gone forth, and goes forth, abandons the home, relatives, wealth, gives everything up, takes the Patimokkha precepts, develops restraint, right livelihood, sense restraint and contentment and all of those things. And as one of those things, one develops mindfulness in daily life. And all of those things lead up to going into seclusion, meditation, sitting down in the forest, meditating, abandon the hindrances, going to the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, all the higher kinds of knowledges, psychic abilities, and finally culminating, realizing the Eightfold Path. And this is taught time and time again, a dozen times, making up the whole suttas. A whole third of the Digha Nikaya is concerned with teaching precisely this teaching. And yet, we can take up that one passage on mindfulness in daily life, present it entirely without reference to the context that it was spoken in, and use it to justify the argument that we don't really need to meditate. Oh, because the Buddha said we just need to be mindful in our daily life. This is kind of maltreatment of the Dhamma, which is not merely incorrect, but is bordering on being unethical. It's like a deliberately misleading. So we have to pay attention to how people are using language and how people are using, like people are quoting texts or quoting teachings. Why are they doing that? What do they mean? What's the context? What did that mean to those people at that time? So we're going to have a look at the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. We have to ask, what did that actually mean to the people at the time? Let's approach these things with a sense of integrity, not because we just want to buttress our own point of view, but because we really want to know, what point was the Buddha making? What did he mean by that? Why did he talk in that way to those people at that time, in that place? So the Buddha, as we all know, lived his life of indulgence in the palace, got sick of that, left home, went out, spent a life of self-mortification in the forest. Then realized that this was a waste of time, so he thought, remembered the time when as a young boy he had sat down under the rose apple tree and entered into the first jhana. And then he wondered, I wonder if that could be the way to enlightenment. That is the way to enlightenment. Eso vamago bodhaya. So if there's any one phrase you want to learn in Pali for this rain retreat, then that is a good one to learn. Eso va, eso, that, va, indeed, mago, path, bodhaya, to enlightenment. For all you budding Pali scholars, now you know what it means. That indeed is the path to enlightenment. So the Buddha had to have something to eat to get the strength back to be able to practice that kind of meditation. So that's why we have a meal in the morning, okay? Remember that. Our kitchen hands. If you don't do your job, none of us can get into samadhi. Yeah? So every day you should be rejoicing that your food is supporting that practice, and that if you can't, if you don't do that, well, we all have to fast. And as the Buddha said, when he had to fast, he said, well, today, never mind, I have to fast, I'll feed on rapture like the radiant devas do. So that's okay, we can, if there's no food for one day or 2 days, we can all just live on rapture for a couple of days. Unfortunately, rapture tends to wear thin after the third or fourth day. But generally speaking, it is important that we have some food to support our minds, because our minds are connected with our body, they're integrated with our body. They're a distinct kind of thing, but they're still integrated with the body, conditioned by it. And if our bodies aren't healthy, if we overeat or undereat, then we're out of balance. So we need to just have the right amount. And we were talking about this a little bit before, about like, you know, people like have all these ideas about food, and they've got to eat this, and you've got to eat that, and you've got to have the iron, and you've got to have the protein, and you've got to have the carbohydrates. And it seems like not only do, you know, as we're saying, we look out in the nature, we see all the animals, like koala bears just managed to live on gum leaves. I don't know, does gum leaves have vitamin B12 in them? Or whatever the things we're supposed to need. Koalas don't actually understand these concepts, but they seem to be fairly healthy. Why is it that we suddenly, all of a sudden, we need to take all these very varied diets and need to balance our diet and all of these kinds of things? And also, why is it that every year they seem to be discovering entirely new kinds of things that we need to be taking we didn't know about when we were growing up, yet we managed to grow up okay? Why is this happening? Perhaps being healthy has nothing to do with that. Perhaps other things have something to do with it. Perhaps other things like, say, having the right attitude when we're preparing food and cooking it. I wonder if that's going to be something that's going to contribute to our health. Just like you can see from those pictures of the water crystals, that when the water crystals associated with someone with the right kind of energy, mental energy, it will transform how the water operates. Perhaps the water in our food is also sensitive to the moods and intentions that we bring to it, so that any food which is here and prepared in a sense of kindness and offering, in a sense of pureness of heart, is going to be the most nutritious food. I wonder if that might be the case, and that any food which is eaten with mindfulness and gratitude and appreciation and care is going to be the most nutritious food. And that is the kind of food that's going to support you to realize nibbana. So the Buddha had his milk rice offered, of course, by Sujata, and after having a good bit of tukka, he went to find this beautiful place to sit and meditate. The lovely riverbanks, gently sloping, of the Niranjara River. Soft banks, the trees, and then the village that wasn't too close or too far, so that he could go for alms around there. He thought, this place is suitable for meditation. So he went there, developed jhanas, developed the various kinds of higher knowledges, what we call the Tevijja, the recollection of past lives, the divine eye that can see beings being born and reborn according to their karma, and then culminating this, the Four Noble Truths. So then, after this episode of his mind inclined to inaction, I wonder if I should teach. Do you think it's possible to share this kind of realization with anyone else? Thought about it for a while. Not really. Things are steeped in delusion and defilements. It's not easy to teach people like that. And then, as we know, Brahma Sahampati came and encouraged him to teach the Dhamma. I don't want to go too much into all of this story. I've told this story several times before, so I don't want to go too much, but just to give enough to give some background. After Brahma Sahampati encouraged him to teach the Dhamma, he decided to teach the group of five ascetics. They had gone from Bodh Gaya to Benares. So the Buddha set out to travel by stages. It's a good walk, and it would have taken him a few weeks at a leisurely pace to get there. Eventually, the group of five monks, when they saw him, they had been disenchanted. Their eyes reverted to luxury. They had been disgusted, in fact, with Gotama. They had been so disappointed, they thought, he's our teacher and guru, that now he's become all luxurious. He's a backslider. He's a sloppy bludger. So they said, we're not going to go out and pay respects to that lazy good-for-nothing. But then they did. There was something about the Buddha, something special, some kind of charisma, some kind of magic in the air that led them to abandon their vow and to go out and receive him. One of them took his bowl, they washed his feet, prepared a sitting place for him, and received him with all due courtesy. So when the Buddha was talking to these group of five monks, how did he persuade them? How did he bring them over to his side? They weren't his devoted followers. Far from it. They were actually actively antagonistic towards him. So he had to use his psychology to get them on side. First, he said, there's these two extremes. The first one is sensual indulgence. So then they thought, yeah, right, sensual indulgence. Because that was their whole life, was orientated to getting rid of, suppressing, crushing, destroying any attachment to any sensual pleasures. They were just indulging. They were just focusing exclusively on tormenting their body so they could get rid of this attachment, because they'd seen that side of things. They'd seen the truth to that extent, that there is this danger in those kind of fancy things in the world that are going to pull you out of your mind, literally. So they'd seen that danger and they thought, no. So they went to the other extreme, tormenting the body, and the Buddha said, this is the second extreme, tormenting your body. And the middle way, of course, that avoids those two extremes is the Noble Eightfold Path. So very important to remember, the middle way is not the mediocre way, it's not the way of compromise. It's not the average way. It's the way that doesn't go anywhere near those two extremes. It's the way that completely goes in a different direction. And this is the Noble Eightfold Path. So I don't want to talk too much about the Noble Eightfold Path this evening. I'll be talking more about that during the Rains Retreat. And also I spoke about it earlier last week in Sydney. So the two aspects of this first discourse, one was the Eightfold Path, the second was the Four Noble Truths. And so for the rest of this talk this evening, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha Samudayani Rodha Magga, suffering, its origin, the cessation, and the path. Now what is there left to say about the Four Noble Truths? What is there that we can bring to that? It's a teaching that's been endlessly analyzed, described, debated, classified for 2,500 years. And because of that, then it becomes stale, doesn't it? You know, it becomes almost like a joke. You kind of joke about something, oh yeah, that's suffering. Can't get the light bulbs to work properly, oh yeah, that's light bulb dukkha. And these things, but we say, oh, that stuff, it's just suffering and so on. It becomes like a joke. And we become so familiar with it that it loses its edge. So we've always got to try to somehow make it fresh again, make it alive. And that involves this kind of continual revolution. We've got to keep on discarding old ways of thinking about these things. Because they're going to become stale. They're right. It's not that they're wrong. They're right. But they just don't cut it anymore. So there are many ways of approaching or thinking about these Four Noble Truths. One of the very important aspects of them is that there's four. Now, it doesn't have to be four, okay? The Buddha could have described it in a different way. This is just a convention that we say there's Four Noble Truths. It's not like there's actually four truths sitting out there in the world, and the Buddha came along and sort of discovered them in their kind of sitting there in their fourness. Yeah? The number four is just a convention. Sometimes the Buddha said, all I talk about is suffering and the ending of suffering. Yeah? So there's two truths there. And sometimes you talk about the origination, the dissolution, the attraction, the danger, and the escape. You know, so that's like five kinds of things. So there's many different ways of talking about it. There's not just four ways. So it's always important to remember this, these kinds of, well, the Four Noble Truths, we can say the Four Noble Truths are in a sense natural laws. They kind of are part of the fabric of how things operate. But the way we describe those laws, the words we use, the concepts we use, they're not kind of embedded in the universe. They are embedded in convention. Okay, and with different sets of conventions, they become expressed in different ways. It's important to remember that this is a distinction that applies also in the field of science and the philosophy of science, but you know, even scientists themselves very, very often don't notice this kind of distinction. That's something I notice frequently when reading science writing, that they will make statements of the kind that, let's say, the ball fall down to the ground under the influence of the law of gravity. As if there's a thing called a law of gravity which is out there in the universe saying to the ball, now you must fall down. Yeah? Completely ridiculous. The laws of nature are not that kind of thing. They're not like, say, the laws of the country, which are things which we invent that actually dictate how we behave. The law of gravity doesn't dictate how objects behave. Newton's laws of motions don't dictate how objects behave. They describe how objects behave. So the laws of science are generalizations which we derive from experience. Okay? They're not things which are imposed on experience, but we learn by watching, seeing how they behave, learning how they behave, and then finding a simple and succinct and powerful way of describing that behavior. And that's what a law of physics is. So if we say something like that, the laws of physics are immutable, they don't change over time. We don't mean that there's an actual thing in the universe which exists, which doesn't change over time, which we can call the laws of physics. What we mean is that things behave in predictable ways, and that the behavior of things can be described in these terms at this time, and they can be described in similar terms at another time. And even though we give a lot of respect these days to the laws of physics, we think that they're somehow very fundamental to the universe. It's interesting that the physicists themselves, or at least some of them, don't treat the laws of physics as being as immutable as all that. And there's been some research recently which suggests that the speed of light is not constant. It's quite interesting, isn't it? You can see that when Einstein wanted to make his theory of relativity, he wanted to make everything relative. Everything was relative to everything else. And but he still was looking for like a fixing point, like a standing point. He realized that the surface of the Earth didn't provide a standing point anymore. There wasn't like still. There was no kind of still point. But the speed of light became a constant. It became like the fixed reference point. He's still looking for that plane on which you can stand and measure everything by. And the speed of light became used like that. But then you realize actually that's impermanent as well. Yeah? Another victory for the law of impermanence. The speed of light is impermanent. It's not a fixed standing point that you can measure everything in the universe by. There isn't any fixed standing point. All you can get is decent approximations. And Einstein and quantum theory and all of those kinds of things, that's all they are, is decent approximations that can describe certain kinds of behavior of physical objects. So we shouldn't think of them as being, in some sense, kind of metaphysical entities which sit out in the world and determine how everything's going to happen. They don't have that kind of power. They're not those that kind of thing. So when we look at the Four Noble Truths, we must be very careful not to try to make the same mistake when we think about the Four Noble Truths. We don't think of it as some kind of entity which is sitting out there in the universe that we can sort of go and enter into or something like that. Four Noble Truths are a description of our behavior, both a description and a prescription. They say what is our experience like, how does consciousness and our mind and our experience work, and it says what do you do about it, how do you respond to that. This is what the Four Noble Truths is about. So there's always this tendency to make things overly concrete. And this is the philosophical term they use, is to reify, to make overly real, to make too real, to reify something. It's like you fossilize them and set them in concrete. And so we want to preserve the Four Noble Truths. So what do you do to preserve them? You pickle them. Okay, the four pickled truths. Yeah, and so they become like an item on your curriculum. Yeah, the four fossilized truths. Yeah, they're kind of buried down there in a kind of substratum of under hundreds of years of accretion, of crust, of dirt. And there they are, these four solid things sitting down there. That's not what the Four Noble Truths are. Four Noble Truths are descriptions of what life is like. Okay? And that description is not meant to be absolute. The Buddha wasn't looking for an absolute in the same sense that Einstein was relying on the speed of light as an absolute. It's not absolute in that sense. The Four Noble Truths are relative to our condition as sentient beings, and they are relative to the situation of a religious seeker. Okay? They are relative to the situation of a religious seeker, because their teachers, doesn't mean that they don't apply to other people who are not religious seekers, but it means that they're not relevant in that kind of context. And to explain that, one of the best examples of that was from, I was reminded of this when some of our guests were here last week, who were espousing lots of rather bizarre and interesting theories and ideas about the world. And it reminded me, we were talking afterwards with Ajahn Sucitto about this wonderful story in Hermann Hesse's The Glass Bead Game, and the story about these two Christian monks who are desert fathers. And it's quite a nice story in many respects, but I won't go into it too much. But anyway, there were these two Christian fathers living together. One of them was very soft and gentle, And whenever anyone came up with any problems to him, all he would do was sigh, and then kiss them. And that was his whole teaching. He'd just sigh them and kiss them. And the other one was like really fierce. He was like the Ajahn Mahabua type. So whenever anyone came up to him with a problem, he'd beat them up. Yeah. Beat them black and blue. And so they were these two were living together in perfect harmony. They're like a perfect couple. And but the violent one was the senior. He'd been ordained longer. So this time this fellow came up to him with all his theories, and he was a Gnostic, and he had all these theories about the nature of God and the cosmos and so on. And he had this idea that the creator deity of the Old Testament, the one who made the world in 7 days, was actually an evil demiurge, they call him, like an evil demon who created the world. And this actually was a view of the ancient Gnostic Christians. They believed that the creator God was an evil demon who created the world in order to inflict suffering on people. Which, you've got to admit, it has a certain kind of logic to it. It's not an unreasonable point of view. And if you want to find some scriptural authority for it, it's not difficult to find basis for the idea that God is an actual sadistic sicko. And it's a kind of fairly well supported by the textual evidence. But anyway, this guy was going on with all these kinds of ideas, and the fierce father didn't say anything. He just sat there and nodded and smiled, and then the very gentle one was getting more and more angry and frustrated. He was sitting there, why didn't he say something? He's got all these terrible heresies. How can he let him get away with this? And the other one was just sitting there very finely smiling. And the gentle one's getting more and more frustrated. And eventually the fellow finished what he had to say and then left. And then the gentle one said to the fierce one, he said, how did you let him get away with that? Why didn't you say anything? He had all these heresies, all these kinds of wrong views. You should have argued with him. You should have shown him that he was wrong. And then the fierce father said, it would have been a waste of time. You know, there's no point. Let him go away and let him suffer for a while. He doesn't know what suffering is. Because he doesn't know what suffering is, he's not sincere in his spiritual seeking. Let him go away. Let him, you know, get married, raise a family. Let him see a few of his children die. Let him see a war. Let him see a famine. Let him suffer from some diseases. And then let him come back. And then we can talk to him. And we'll be able to communicate. So this is what I mean when I say that the Four Noble Truths are relative to that context of a spiritual seeker. Then outside of that context, they're not a teaching, okay? They're just a doctrine. If I'm not interested in suffering and the origin of suffering and so on, then learning about the Four Noble Truths is completely irrelevant. It's like a waste of time. I mean, you can put it in a school curriculum and teach it to a room full of school kids, and it's a total waste of time because they're just learning it as another bunch of facts in their curriculum. But it's when somebody's ready to hear that, when they actually need that, when they are struck with suffering, when they have that arrow which hits them in the heart and is buried deep in the chest and they need something to get out of it, that's when the Four Noble Truths are true. That's when the Four Noble Truths are real. They are made real because of the context. They come alive because of the context. So the Buddha said that that experience of suffering leads to one of two results. Either it leads to despair. Yeah? So there's a very nice cartoon about that in the paper today. Michael Lunig said, what's the definition of globalization? He said globalization is when you have a man in Hobart and a woman in Tokyo and a mouse in Paris and a dolphin in Madagascar, all of them feeling despair at the same time. Globalization. So when you have suffering in your life, that's what tends to happen. We tend to feel despair. So either we're prodded to despair or to a search. One of those two things. We start looking. Where is there someone who can say one word that can ease my mind? One word that can address this kind of suffering and pain in my heart? Is there someone like that in the world? So that's when we start looking for some teachings, looking for a teacher. And it is interesting that, although that is, it is changing to some degree, but you do notice that people tend to contact Buddhism a lot through a living teacher. And that's been a very important part of the traditions, even though these days, I admit that is changing. You have people contacting Dhamma through books and through the internet and so on, getting interested in it. But often it's much more powerful if there's an actual living teacher there, especially for people who want to meditate. I've noticed that rarely do people actually start to meditate by just learning from a book. Almost always they start learning because they have an encounter with a teacher. So we want to search, we want to find, where is that? Where's something that's actually going to answer this problem, that's going to actually address these issues? And so that's, of course, where you hear the Buddha talk about the Four Noble Truths. And so the Buddha is addressing those Four Noble Truths to that context. They're addressing people who are in that situation, who have had suffering in their lives, and who are seeking for an answer to it. That's the audience. That's the context that makes these Four Noble Truths meaningful. So in a sense, it doesn't really matter what the cause of that suffering is. And we can kind of endlessly analyze those different forms of suffering. And really, I find it overwhelming sometimes. It's quite incredible, the variety and intensity of the kinds of suffering that people have and have had in their lives. And when you're kind of talking to people, they're like, goodness, it's just, people go through so much. People who are refugees, people who have been in wars, people who have had dreadful illnesses, people who are having to just live for years in comas, or the most intense kinds of suffering that we can be experienced. One time I heard a story, a true story this happened a few years ago. I heard the story when I was staying in Malaysia. It didn't happen in Malaysia, it happened in, not sure where it happened. But this boy who was about 16 or 17 started to complain about feeling stomach ache. And they couldn't diagnose it, and so on. Eventually they gave him an x-ray, and they found out that in his stomach he had his twin brother, and his Siamese twin brother had formed and been born inside his stomach, and had actually lived until that time, until he was like 16 or 17. He'd been alive and only just died, and when he died, his body started to decompose, and that was what was causing the stomach ache. The next time you get a bit of a tummy ache, you should think, oh, what's going on there? The boy, I think he did, yeah, they had an operation, removed the brother's body. Now, isn't that intense suffering? We think we're suffering in life. Yeah? We think, oh, it's terrible if I can't find the right kind of tea to drink in the morning or something. I think that's suffering. But it's the most outrageous, intense suffering that people can have. And it's very common. It's not unusual. You know, it's not like that's just a kind of oddity. I mean, it's just everyone's got those kinds of stories. You know, everyone has just intense suffering. Everyone has people close to them who die. Everyone gets very sick in their life. Everyone suffers from intense physical pain. Everyone goes through emotional anguish and hardship. Intense suffering, not just a bit of kind of trivial dissatisfaction. So it's one of the things Ajahn Brahm says is dukkha. They like to translate dukkha as kind of dissatisfaction. It doesn't mean dissatisfaction. It means suffering, 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 suffering. Pain, agony. That's what it means. This is what people's lives are like. You know, when walking down the street, always good to remind yourself about everyone you see. They're all kind of putting on these fronts. They're always kind of walking down the road as if they're saying, well, I'm okay, you know? This kind of bundle of bones and blood and flesh is just kind of trotting cheerfully down the road as if there's nothing wrong with the world. You know? And my goodness, there's someone who's just been yelled at by their boss. There's somebody whose girlfriend has just had a miscarriage, somebody who's just been told that they're diabetic, whatever it might be. And so our life is lived among this kind of sense of trauma, the sense of dislocation, alienation, and these various kinds of sufferings, all the way from the obvious ones like injury and so on to these very subtle, pervasive kinds of suffering, like kind of alienation. So that's kind of a modern form of suffering. We like to think it's a modern form of suffering. We like to think that kind of existential angst is a kind of modern thing, invented by the kind of the punk generation or something like that. I used to think that it was kind of a modern thing until I read this inscription by Tukulti, I can't remember his name now. But anyway, he lived in Egypt about 2000 BC. And the most powerful of the Egyptian pyramid texts. Every day I would go to the temple and make the offerings. I was so full of faith and devotion. My God was there by my side and my goddess too, and I would go there and make the oblations, and they would bless me and make my life happy and full. But now they vanish. Now my God is nowhere to be seen. My goddess has left me from my side. My name is abhorred like the odor of birds on the sun-scorched day. Death lies before me today, like the home that a man longs to see after years spent as a captive. This is the first recorded existential crisis in history. So, you know, the obvious response to make, you know, when we do this, when we experience this kind of suffering, obviously the first thing you want to do is to try and blame someone, which is always great fun. And these days we like to blame the Muslims. It's the terrorists. Terrorists this, terrorists that, they're the ones to blame. Terrorists did this, terrorists did that. And you know, it's all kind of terrible that kind of the terrorists have done so many things. And we're living in Australia. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think a single person has ever died of any terrorist act on Australian soil. And yet our lives are full of all the terrible things that the terrorists are doing. There's plenty of innocent Iraqis who have died in Iraq because of the acts of Australian soldiers. No shortage of them. But not a single Australian has died in Australia from a terrorist act. And yet somehow terrorism is this horrible thing. That this kind of menace that's looming over us. It's a bit pathetic, really. I remember when I was growing up, there was the menace was nuclear holocaust. At least it's something you can get your teeth into. At least it's something, you know, really bad. The kind of terrorism, the worst they can do is kill a few thousand people. They can't sort of bring civilization to a halt. You know, the worst terrorist act, even the bombing and killing of the World Trade Center, is the worst terrorist act in history, but it's much less destructive than just about any war that you can mention. Any war is worse than that. But yet somehow war isn't the problem, it's terrorism that's the problem, and war is the solution. It's always kind of looking outside to try and blame people, and blame. And of course that's, you know, these days we like to think of people very strong, you know, people like we say, people have got backbone. That's the latest thing that our beloved Prime Minister has, according to Mr. Bush, he's got backbone. So there you go. We thought he was, we were being governed by a jellyfish or something. He's got backbone. But that's what the real courage is, isn't it? The real hero is the one who's able to forgive. And the one who's saying, no, they're not going to look out there trying to solve a problem. I'm going to look in here and find the problem. So, of course, in Buddhism, we teach you've got to start with yourself. Of course we should try to do what we can on a social level. We should try to help the people around us, the society, and all of those kinds of things. But that's only ever skin deep. Never going to solve the problems. And like Ajahn Sucitto commented, he said, you know, we can't expect too much from our politicians. You know? They're only people, only men and women. They've got all their constraints and problems. They've got to worry about getting re-elected, all those kinds of things. Can't expect too much from them. So we have to start looking inside ourselves. Where am I causing myself suffering? Now, it's easy enough to do this on a simple level, yeah? It's easy enough to realize, well, if I want to eat lots of chocolate, then I'm going to make myself sick. Okay, well, I can understand that. That's fairly simple, cause and effect. But it's one of the things about the nature of these Four Noble Truths is that they're kind of like they spiral down to the depths. It's like a whirlpool. It's kind of as we go into them, spinning, 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 we keep on going down. The same patterns going over and over again, but the depth of it and the power of it keeps on getting more and more intense as we get closer to the center. So we start to uncover layers of experience and layers of consciousness that are being constructed by our own cravings in very subtle ways that we hadn't even imagined possible. So fair enough, we can understand, well, look, if I have a desire to go and see a movie, well, I go to the movie and I have that experience. I have the experience of seeing the movie, and the experience of seeing the movie is a result of having the desire of seeing the movie. But what about having the experience of seeing? What about if we were to generalize that and say, not just the experience of seeing this or that sight, but the experience of seeing is a result of our desire? What happens if we don't want to see? What happens if we just don't have any desire to feed our mind with that kind of food? We don't have the desire to feed our mind with that kind of stimulus. What happens then? What happens if you really have complete equanimity towards the eye and towards the things that you see? Not even equanimity, but a sense of repulsion, like the two positive poles of a magnet. And when brought together, they repulse each other because you see that suffering. What if you were really to see not simply that this sight or that sight is suffering, but that seeing is suffering? The sights are suffering, the eye is suffering, the eye consciousness is suffering. All those things coming together we call the eye contact. That's suffering, and all the feelings from that are suffering, even the pleasant ones. They're all suffering too. And all the intentions that I get around that, the act of attention, of having to pay attention to these sights, that too is suffering. What if I was to see all of these things are suffering? What then? What would I want to do with the eye? What would I want to do if I see that that is nothing but a pit of burning coals? What would happen? If you were to really see that, to really understand that, then you would be able to turn away from that eye consciousness. Not that you would be able to sit there and see things mindfully. Again, this is a way that Buddhism just gets watered down by people who don't really understand what the whole point of it is. It's not that you just sit there and experience dukkha mindfully. It's not what the Buddha taught. Mindfulness is part of the path. It's not the goal. Not the goal of Buddhism to experience dukkha mindfully. The goal of Buddhism is to get out of dukkha. And it's because we are, our craving is building up this world of dukkha. That's why we experience it. And if we don't have that craving, we don't have that dukkha. It doesn't exist anymore. The I does not exist anymore for us. It might exist for a doctor. A doctor might come along and say, yeah, well, there's this kind of globular thing and I can poke it and prod it with my instruments. Yeah. In that sense, an I might exist, but for us, living inside here, it's simply not there. Where is it? You can't see it, because you're not interested in it anymore. So it's as if, like, in the spiritual path, we can outgrow these things, and they simply don't exist for us anymore. Just like when we're kids, we're interested in watching Play School or Sesame Street. You go there, you watch that. How many of us have thought about Play School in the last day or so? Probably hardly any of us, if at all. But when we were kids, it probably figured very largely in our lives. And it was very prominent for us. Now it just doesn't exist for us until it gets recalled. That's the same way with the I. It doesn't exist for us anymore because we're not interested in it. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, they disappear. They're not interested, and we don't have that attachment to them. So that kind of disappearance of things is what the Buddha was talking about as the third noble truth, the ending of suffering. So of course the ending of the primary meaning of the ending of suffering is the ending of attachment, the ending of desire, wanting those things. And when the desire for those things ends, the things themselves end, because they were cooked up by desire in the first place. The reason why we have a body is because we had craving and attachment in our past lives. That's why we've cooked up this mortal frame. That's why we have eyes, because we had attachment to seeing things in a past life. And so that attachment generated eyes in order to feed itself. That's why we have ears, because we were attached to hearing sounds in our past life, and that attachment cooked up a new pair of ears so we can listen in this life. Just like if you're attached to music, you go out and buy a stereo. If you don't have that attachment to it, you don't buy the stereo. It doesn't exist for you. It's not like somehow magically the stereo comes into your life whether you like it or not, and you mindfully have it there or you don't have it. It just isn't there anymore. So the mind is cooking up this experience, creating it in order to feed itself, in order to feed its own sense of identity, to gratify its own sense of identity. And notice how we feed off this sense experience. Notice how we get turned into consumers. When we see something attractive, it's like we want to suck it in. We want to own it. We want to possess it. Our mind becomes orientated towards treating that as an object for our own kind of gratification. In feminist theory, they often talk about the way that media and so on objectifies women's bodies, turns them into objects. So it's not, you're not actually seeing the person, but you're seeing like an object. But that's just like a special case of a more general attitude towards sensory objects. We objectify them. And so when we're seeing people, we're not actually seeing people anymore. We're seeing either objects for gratification or repulsion. And we're trying to devote our lives to maximizing those pleasant things and minimizing the unpleasant things. And that is to say, building up. No, it's not something that just happens to us. It's something we diligently, energetically strive to do every moment of the day, to build up this world which is going to affirm ourselves. That is what the fabric of our life consists of. It consists of an environment which our consciousness has cooked up in order to gratify its own self, of its own sense of self. We surround ourselves with objects, we surround ourselves with people, we surround ourselves with ideas that are all going to gratify our own sense of self. And this is where our world is made. The world isn't made in a big bang. That's just another symptom. That's not the cause. The world isn't manufactured by the laws of physics. The laws of physics change. They're not constant. They're not like a bedrock that you can build the universe out of. They're just a way of describing things. The world is built out of our desires and our attachments. When we let go of those desires and attachment, then this is the ending of the world. So this is why the Buddha said that the world is our six senses. And we can describe the Four Noble Truths in terms of the world, the origin of the world, the ending of the world, and the way leading to the ending of the world. So that's a very cheerful thought, isn't it? Oh, we're practicing the Eightfold Path so we can make an end of the world. So because we have this, it's like this process is ongoing and it's continually being fueled. Actually, you know, it doesn't have to happen. It doesn't have to be that way. When we talk about the ending or the cessation of the world, you don't have to end anything. You don't have to make the world cease. You don't have to make suffering cease. Suffering ceases by itself. Dukkhameva upajjamanam upajjati dukkham niruddhamanam niruddhati. Dukkha is only dukkha arising. Dukkha is only dukkha ceasing. Yeah? Dukkha just comes and goes. It's not anything absolute. It's just the condition of things. When we stop cooking it up, when we stop fueling the fire, when we stop feeding those flames of dukkha, then they just go out by themselves. Yeah? So I don't have to get a fire pack and spray it down with water to make the dukkha go away. You just stop putting wood on the fire and then it burns out by itself. This is what it means, like the ending of suffering. So they have this word, beautiful word in Pali, or kaya, or in Sanskrit, shaya. And it's usually translated as destruction, which is not a very nice kind of translation, but kaya means, it's not used in the sense of destroying something, that's another word, but kaya means like the waning of the moon, is the kaya of the moon. Or when a stream dries up in the hot season, it's called the kaya of the stream. Or if one runs out of supplies, and then that's the kaya of the supplies. So it's like the running out, the waning of something. So this is what happens to dukkha. The dukkha is wanes. It vanishes, it evaporates. And it's like evaporates. This is what Buddhism, that's that leading to the evaporation of suffering. So this is what we call Nibbana, or the third of the Four Noble Truths. The ending of suffering. What is it like? It's not like anything. Yet this kind of philosophy, they call it like a category mistake, where you're kind of asking a question, but it's about something which is a different kind of thing than the question is asking. And so this is like a category mistake. You ask, what is Nibbana like? And we can say it's like something in terms of, use a simile for it. But when we use a simile for it, all we're doing is like painting a rosy glow around it. That's all that the similes are. We say it's a harbour, a place of refuge, a place of safety. We say it's the peaceful, the sublime. And so none of those words mean anything. All they do is just paint a rosy glow around Nibbana. They make it feel attractive to us so that we want to reach it. Paramang Sukhang is ultimate bliss. Nibbanang Paramang Sukhang. Nibbana is ultimate bliss. Of course, it's not the ultimate bliss of feeling good. But if it's not the bliss of feeling good, what does it mean? It doesn't matter what that means. What it matters is that that's painting a picture that makes you want to practice and realize it. And we have faith that the Buddha realized it and said, yeah, this is ultimate bliss. So we say, okay, let's go for it. Then we experience it. When we experience it, it's not like anything because it's not another kind of experience. Nibbana isn't a variety of experience, so we can say this experience is like that experience. It's a completely different kind of thing. In fact, it's not any kind of thing. But it's something we don't have any categories for or any words for. Yasanati upamakati, that for which there is no simile. Sanghiram sankupang, feedable, unshakable, yasanati upamakvachi. What else do we say about it? What we say is the rest of the lines of that verse. Adha gamisami nametta ganka. For sure, I will go there. I have no doubt about that. Evang mangdharihi adhimutta chittanti. You may bear me in mind as one whose mind is made up. Remember me as one who's made up their mind. Yeah, so that's what we think about Nibbana. We don't think about what does it mean when the Buddha said it's unshakable and unassailable. What does that mean? What we do is we say, Adha gamisami, for sure, I will go there. Nametta kanka, I have no doubt of that. And that's what we think about Nibbana. So as we say, staying here together for the 3 months of the rains retreat, practicing the Eightfold Path together, never lose sight of that. Never lose sight of that context, no matter what happens. Remember, it can happen any time. Nibbana is just there, all the time. It is just there. It is not somewhere else. It's not at the end of the rains retreat. It's not at the end of this course of meditation. It's not like at the end of this road somewhere else. It's not anywhere. It is right there when greed, hate, and delusion end in your mind. That is what we call Nibbana. And if you stay on that edge, if you keep walking on that razor's edge, where you are aware, what is happening? Where is that greed? Where is that hatred? Where is that delusion? If you stay on that razor's edge all the time, any time, then that can happen to you. And don't let anyone tell you different. Don't let anyone tell you you've got this is the Dharma ending age, and all this kind of rubbish that you can't realize Dhamma now, or we have to practice for millions of years until we can, millions of lifetimes, and realize all this complete, utter rubbish. Nibbana is right there. And in thousands and millions of lifetimes, Nibbana is going to be exactly where it is now, which is nowhere. In the Buddha's time, Nibbana was exactly where it is now, which is nowhere. It wasn't easier to attain the Dhamma in the Buddha's time than it is now. It's exactly the same. There's no point in trying to be reborn in the time of Maitreya Buddha. There's no point in trying to, you know, practice your paramis over many lifetimes. All of these things, all of these things are just excuses for not practicing. Nibbana is right in your mind, here and now, as soon as you want to let go of stupidity. Stupidity always causes suffering. When you can let go of that stupidity, you will see the truth. So never forget this context when you're staying here for the Range Retreat. We were talking about a bit earlier about like what, you know, what is it that makes Buddhism a religion? And this is the thing that makes it a religion. It's not the fact that we do rituals and we have a monastic institution and all of these kinds of things. It's not the fact that we've got tax exempt status and so on. These are not what make us a religion. The fact that what makes us a religion is that we have this idea of this complete transcendental good, not just a partial good, not just everyday neurosis, as Freud said. You know, the best we can hope for is everyday neurosis, not that kind of good, not just making things a bit better, not just bodging it up so we can get through the day, not that kind of good, but real, total, utter, complete freedom and liberation. And that's the context. That's the context of Buddhism. So it's in that sense that Buddhism is a true religion. So never forget that. Keep bearing that in mind. Bear that context in mind. Whatever you're doing, whether you're brushing your teeth, whether you're sitting meditation, whether you're talking to somebody in the kitchen, whether you are shaving your head, whether you are going to the toilet, whatever it is that you're doing, never forget that context. This is our life. Our life is here for one sake and one sake only, and that is the sake of realizing Nibbana. Nothing else matters. So in this Range Retreat, for most of you it'll be your first Range Retreat. Some of you have been here, Venerable Pichato and myself have done quite a few, about 10 Range Retreats or something now. And the Heresy is his second. So a few of us have some experience with the Range Retreat. Darren also. So we have that experience. Others, brothers, it's the first one. So really make it special. Make it that time. Make it that thing you focus your energy, the special time that you can focus your energy so you can really apply yourself to meditation. And in the coming weeks, each week I will, as this talk has been like a general overview of the truths of Buddhism, in the next few weeks I will gradually talk more about the practical details of meditation and so on, the things we actually have to do. But just to keep on reminding ourselves of the context, never forget that, never lose sight of that. So this is all I have to say for you this evening on the Four Noble Truths. I hope that's been of some benefit for you all. I'd like to open up if anyone has any comments or questions.
I appreciate what you had shared with us today, particularly in terms of what you said about mindfulness not being the goal, because I have certainly thought that was the case many times, that mindfulness is the goal, and that's what's put out, I have heard put out a lot by various very high profile Western teachers. And so it's I appreciate hearing what you have to say, reminding me.
Okay, if there's no more questions, I can finish my paying respects.